Welcome to Open Book. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Carrie Perloff, who is the Artistic Director of American Conservatory Theater in San Francisco. Now going on how many years?
22!
Carrie Perloff was primary people responsible in restoring the Geary Theater and restoring ACT to its former glory. Each time I talk to an artistic director, I want to hit another avenue of creating theater. So let's talk a little bit about how a set gets built. There are two kinds of sets. For Venus and Fur, which is playing now through this weekend, it's the same set I saw in New York, essentially, but a lot of times it's a different set. At your end, how does a set come together?
Well, as a producer, I'm responsible for putting together the teams of people that create the work. So one of the first things you do with the director, or if I'm directing it, I do it with myself and my team, is who are the right designers? And that has to do with how do you envision the piece. So for Major Barber, Dennis Garnham had a very kind of bold, fluid understanding of that play. He wanted it to feel incredibly immediate and contemporary. He didn't want it to be a box set. And so Dan Osling, of course, came to mind because he's such an extraordinary visionary designer. Once they started working together, Dan's first image were those giant bombs suspended in the air in the last act of the play. So they designed the last act first and backed out of it. Set design is both vision and logistics, just like architecture. You have things that you see in your gut that you think will be magical visually that will tell the story of the play. And then you have to figure out how does it all get stored backstage? Does it fly? Does it track? Is it automated? Does it come up from below? How does it all go together? How many crew members does it take? So it's a fascinating discipline. When the wonderful local designer Nina Ball did Underneath the Lintel for us, that was a kind of urban archaeology. She and I went digging in our scene shop and our prop shop, and we found artifacts, or what in that play would be called evidences. And we put together an environment for David Strathairn to live in as the librarian in that play. And at the end of each show, we let the audience come on stage and look at it all. So every set design is its own journey.
What about the set for Napoli? How did that come together?
A lot of research. Eric Flatmo, that designer, is absolutely precise about the world. So he looked at Naples post-war, the bombing, the situation on the ground, the narrow streets, the atmosphere, the lighting, the decor, and it evolved very collaboratively with Mark Record. There are two central things in that play, the bed and that central table, and everything happens around that. And then the set dressing for that piece was the most complicated because 300 pounds of coffee had to go into the mattress and be hidden and be revealed. So set design has a lot of tricks.
I've noticed at different theaters, I've seen shows where there's stuff going on that the audience can barely see. Kitchens that kind of vanish,
right.
Things like that. I mean, are we seeing everything? I mean, how does that work?
You mostly are seeing everything because every square foot of scenery costs money. And so you don't need to build an entire kitchen if you're going to see the back wall and the sink. So it will look like verisimilitude when you are sitting in your seat, Richard, at the Geary. It'll look in 4,000 miles, let's say, that beautiful Amy Herzog play, like her kitchen is complete. If you actually walked in there, you would see what you see on stage, and then there would be an empty flat. Of course, the sight lines are such that you have to make sure from every corner you're seeing something. And that's the fun part.
So somebody actually goes to the worst seat in the house
in
each direction.
Oh, yeah. We do sightline maps so that we can see what everyone's going to see, both from the far sides but also up above.
Another theater company recently did a show, and a third of the audience couldn't see something because it was blocked off. I guess that would seem to me to be a mistake.
That is not okay. So I take that incredibly seriously. We have a very tight sightline box on our grid for our looking at the theater, and when we hire designers, it's the first thing we talk about. I think if somebody's paying a ticket to come see a show, they deserve to see the show. You know, having said that, obviously in different places in the house, you're going to get different views and see different things, but if there's critical action, you absolutely need to see it as an audience member, unless you are buying an obstructed view seat.
In which case you know in advance.
Sure.
Carrie Perloff, The Strand is opening in 2015. There are two theaters in there, I think, right?
I like to look at it as a whole ecosystem. There's the Geary, which is sort of like the sun. You know, it's very central. It will always be very central to our work. And then there will be these fabulous other planets. And the Strand will have two spaces. It has a 300-seat end stage with flexible cabaret seating if we want to shake up the seating. Every seat a great seat, perfect acoustics. And a 125-seat flexible black box theater upstairs overlooking City Hall, which we'll also be able to use for educational purposes and for classroom time and for events. And then next door to it sits our sweet 49-seat funky costume shop theater. So essentially, we're going to have a whole arts complex over there at 7th and Market.
A show like Venus and Fur, I saw it in a smaller theater in New York. If you had the opportunity to do it in the Strand, would you have done it in the Strand?
Not necessarily. The Geary can be remarkable for small plays. Some of our biggest successes at the Geary have been small cast plays. They have to be plays that are really rich linguistically and highly theatrical to work at the Geary. If you're doing very intimate theater, that is not what the Geary is for. But Venus is a muscular, highly theatrical play. There are other plays, whether they're large or small cast, that are intimate, which are less suited to the Geary. So the Strand will be an opportunity to explore a repertoire that is either riskier than we'd want to do at the Geary because it's a really unknown author, title, younger artist, whatever, or something that really wants to be seen at very close range.
World premieres. I've noticed a lot of companies now doing more world premieres. They're doing more new play commissions. And it seems to be across the board. What do you think is going on? Is it serendipitous that things are coming to fruition now, or are we seeing some kind of change in the theatrical climate?
I think it's a number of things. I think it's where the funding is. Most large foundation funding now is directed towards new plays. And so, you know, artists go where the resources are, and that's a piece of it. I think we've seen a huge diminution in classical theater. For lots of reasons, people aren't studying it anymore. Actors aren't being trained to do it in the same way. They're longer, they're more expensive, so there are many fewer productions of major classical plays, with probably the exception of Shakespeare, whereas new work is often much smaller, two or three characters, one set, so that makes it somewhat easier. And I also think people feel it's a way to stay current and to get newer audiences, and people are interested in contemporary issues.
You have two works I saw on your website that are coming up then?
Well, we have a lot of work in commission. I mean, we have always commissioned a lot of work, but the Strand will absolutely give us an opportunity to develop more new work and to produce more new work. And I'll give you an example in that regard when you asked about Venus. Last year, we did a world premiere that I still treasure and love thinking about called Stuck Elevator, a contemporary music theater piece about a Chinese delivery guy stuck in an elevator in the Bronx. It turned out to be a huge success, but our runs at the Geary are very short because it's 1,000 seats, so 4 or 5 weeks and it's over. If I'd had to do it over and we'd had the Strand, I would have put Stuck Elevator in the Strand, because with a brand new piece that no one's heard of, the Strand runs will be much longer. The subscription, we're doing two subscription plays of our 7 subscription shows. 2 will be at the Strand, and because it's 300 seats as opposed to 1,000, they will need to run much longer, and that means there's much more time for word of mouth to develop. So with something brand new where you'd like people to hear about it, and it doesn't have an advance sale because no one knows what it is and it hasn't been reviewed, the smaller theater will be invaluable.
Would you be able to move something that was very successful that could transfer over
Sure.
from one to the other?
Yeah, it's wonderful to have multiple spaces because it just gives you infinitely more flexibility both ways. Or you commission work and then you see what it comes out to be and where it is best suited to land. And that's the dream, is to say this play wants to go in this kind of space. Let's support it there.
Carrie Perloff, the shows for 2013 to 2014, we have 1776, Under the Lintel, Major Barbara, Napoli, and going back to the last time we talked, the shows between that were Black Watch, Arcadia, and Stuck Elevator. So which show do you think surprised you, which one you thought was most successful, and which one, if you had it to do over again, you might have done a little differently?
Well, it depends on how you define success. In terms of ticket sales, Stuck Elevator was certainly not the most successful, but artistically, it was thrilling, and it launched some major new voices and brought a major new audience. You know, Arcadia, to work on that play again with that group of artists and sell that number of tickets, it was hugely successful financially, was beyond thrilling. But equally, to bring a company like Blackwatch and pull that off at the Armory, which we all thought could be an enormous disaster if our audiences hadn't been willing to go to 16th and Mission, was also really, really gratifying. One that makes me laugh is Underneath the Lintel, because David Strathairn is so self-effacing and kept saying, no one will come see me in 1,000 seats and we should do this in a closet. And it turned out to be, in terms of ticket sales, one of the most successful shows we've ever done. So they're all very unpredictable, you know, and success depends on lots of things, on audience, but also on breaking ground, on introducing something different. You know, my feeling about Napoli is the chance to see Shauna McKenna and Marco Baricelli on stage together, two of the great lions of the North American theater, will not happen again easily. That was kind of amazing. And Shaw, I will be completely honest and say, I'm not a Shavian. It's not at the top of my list, but this one, because Dennis Garnham kind of really reinvented that play, startled me as to the kind of discussions it engendered after the play. And that's another measure of success. What is the audience talking about when they leave? The arguments about philanthropy and dirty money and the morality of giving were so vociferous after that play. It was incredible. And then that whole production went to Calgary and had a really successful run. And I always think when you can introduce your work to a totally different market, that's also another definition of success.
Which one do you think, if you had it to do over again, you might have done something differently?
Wow. It's so funny. This has actually been, knock on wood, a really luck year. I've been really proud of the work. I will say one thing I would have done differently, and I don't quite know how, but 1776 with the great Frank Galati, the thing that he did that made that worth doing again was that the arguments and compromises and really vicious divide of the Congress were made so palpable. I don't know that how we visualize the show in terms of marketing and everything necessarily let people realize how completely current that play was. So I think there were people who thought, well, 1776, it's a period piece. It was actually a play about right now. And if I had that to do it over, I would think differently about how to talk about that.
And from my perspective, seeing Major Barbara, it's a very peculiar play because Shaw was a socialist, yet the strongest speech is a pro-capitalist speech. So you walk in there going, what?
Yeah. Well, to me, that is the dialectic of great theater. And I've always believed that. I think that the joy of writing plays and the joy of doing plays is that you put all the arguments of the world in the strongest possible ways into multiple different mouths. And sometimes great writers gave their nemeses the best arguments, and that's what Shaw did in Major Barbara. You can't resist Andrew Undershaft. And yet what he is arguing is very disturbing.
You had to use a version of the play that was in the public domain,
correct,
which was an earlier version,
yes,
correct?
Yes, correct. You know, one always gets to choose, and that's a really interesting thing. That saves you tens of thousands of dollars in royalties. And in that case, it wasn't an enormous compromise. You know, Shaw never stopped noodling with this play, so you have to choose one.
Carrie Perloff, let's talk a little bit about the upcoming two plays of this season. The first is The Suit, opens April 22nd. It's set outside Johannesburg during the apartheid era. So let's go back to that first question, the set. What is the set and how did it get created?
To me, this is the total magic of theater. I went to see The Suit, directed by the great, great, great Peter Brook, who is 89 years old young this year. I went to see it at BAM last year just because I would never miss a chance to see a Peter Brook production. This is an adaptation of a Calm Temba short story that uses two rugs, two wardrobe racks, and four chairs. And out of that totally simple universe, an entire world is conjured. So if you have a great imagination, like Peter Brook, you don't need scenery. And that's one of the hallmarks of Peter Brook's theater, actually, is that he uses extremely minimal means and he conjures an entire world. It's an absolutely magical production and utterly worth it. What you can learn from a master like that is incalculable. His production from the Bouffe du Nord in Paris.
If Strand were open, would that have been the theater?
No, I think it'll sit beautifully. I saw it at the Majestic at BAM, which is bigger than the Geary, and it held perfectly. It has remarkable music and extraordinary performances. It's a big story.
You're listening to an interview with Carrie Perloff, who's the artistic director of ACT in San Francisco. Venus in Fur runs through April 13th, and The Suit begins on April 22nd, and opening night is April 30th. I'm Richard Walensky on Open Book. Carrie Perloff, the last play of the season is The Orphan of Zhao with B.D. Wong, and it's been described as the Chinese Hamlet.
The Orphan of Zhao has been called the Chinese Hamlet, in part because it is a story about revenge and about fathers and sons. Interestingly, in its form, I find it more Brechtian than Shakespearean. We are using a troupe of 12 actors who are playing multiple roles to tell this tale, and it is an incredible tale. It is about a doctor, played by B.D. Wong, a very simple country man who has finally, at age 40-something, had a son, a baby. At the court, the Zhao clan is being massacred by an evil emperor, and an orphan is saved. And the doctor is asked to raise that child and to sacrifice his own son in order to save the Orphan of Zhao. So it's a story of sacrifice and a mistaken identity, and finally that child grows up and finds out who he is in an incredible scene with a painted scroll, and the doctor, who has sacrificed everything, sees that clan be saved. So it's an epic tale. It was a Ming Dynasty play. It was then translated in the 18th century by Voltaire, became a very popular classic in the West, and then disappeared again. But this is part of ACT's initiative to deeply explore Asian and Asian American inspired work with an entire Asian American company and remarkable design team. And I think it will be really, I hope, a great rediscovery of a major classic.
And let's go back to the set. What's the set situation, or is it still too early?
Oh, no, it's not too early at all. It's design. It is a bamboo scaffold with ladders that almost looks like a giant birdcage, but quite simple, with some very beautiful drops, all inspired by both ancient and contemporary Chinese art. So we all went to see this beautiful contemporary show at the Metropolitan Museum called Ink Art, with all the greatest contemporary Chinese artists, and a lot of the imagery in it was inspired by that. But it's a very flexible universe. Byron O. Young, who did the music for Stuck Elevator, is creating the score, which is cello and all the actors doing all the sounds and lots of songs.
The idea of the basic elements of the set, does that come from a discussion? Is that the designer
yes.
coming to you?
All the design team comes together, and the director will sit and say, this is how I see the play. This is why I want to do it. This is what I think it's about. This is how I imagine staging it. Here are some of the things I think I'm going to need. So I started by saying, I want this to be performed by a company of actors who transform. I want the audience to know they're with that company of actors. There's a lot of direct address. It is not realistic. They make all the music. They do all the scene changes. So I set those parameters, and then Dan Osling, who is doing scenery, Linda Cho, who's doing costumes, Lap Chi Chu, who's doing lighting, Byron O. Young, who's doing music, all respond from their respective departments.
And how does money play into that? Because you've got a limit. No, seriously, you've got a limited budget. There's got to be a point where you're going, say, on the Peter Brook show, thank God, two chairs.
Well, but you try to draw your lesson from the great masters and say, what is the most exquisite way to do this that is simple? You always have to cut. It doesn't matter whether you're doing Spider-Man the musical or a $200 show. You always have designed something that is more than you can afford. Then you sit down with your team and you say, again, what's essential? What can we lose? What's another way to tell this moment that doesn't need another costume change or a set piece moving or whatever? And you strip away and strip away and strip away until you can afford it. And, you know, we have a wonderful production team here who helps us do that. And in the end, we put something on stage that we can afford to do that we also think is a beautiful way to tell the story.
Well, you also know that certain shows are going to require a little bit more, like,
yes,
say,
sir.
Tales of the City did.
Of course, of course. And you budget accordingly.
Let's talk about next season. Old Hats with Bill Irwin and David Shiner originally came from New York Signature Theater, and it's a sequel of some kind.
Bill and David, as I'm sure your whole listening audience will remember, made an extraordinary piece called Full Moon over a decade ago. We brought it back twice to ACT. It's one of the huge successes we've ever had. They are two of the greatest clowns in America, and they're getting older, and they joke all the time. We call this show Old Cats, but anyway, they talk all the time about what does it mean to be a physical performer when you're 60, as Bill is now. And so they did a meditation on that, and Old Hats is that journey. It has some new iterations of kinds of material that they'd started in Full Moon, and then lots of other new sketches, all tied together with a whole new kind of music. So it is the next part of their journey of being clowns in the modern world.
Mr. Burns, a post-electric play. I understand it's based on an episode of The Simpsons called Cape Fear, F-E-A-R-E. Does the audience need to see that episode? Would that help before they...
Well, that's a very good question, Richard. And the answer is yes and no. I will admit to your listening audience, I'm embarrassed to say, I'm not a Simpsons aficionado on any level. I did not see this production, but I read the play, and I was smitten by the play, not because I knew The Simpsons, but because the conceit of the play is this. When you have gone through an apocalypse and some people survive, what bits of culture do they carry with them? Who are we? And that's what we care about when we think about art, is that art survives. Narrative survives, character survives, culture survives in some way. So this is a group of people after an unnamed apocalypse coming together, and they're trying to remember an episode of The Simpsons. Whether or not you know that episode, what you see is people trying to hold on to their past. And it's brilliantly done. This is a Bay Area born writer. Annie Washburn grew up in Berkeley, went to our Young Conservatory, so that's thrilling to me. Once you go see the episode, if you just watch it on YouTube, of course it helps you figure out the details in the play. So if we can get the rights, we will try to air it beforehand and also email it to our audience in some way so that people will get a chance to see it before they see the show.
So you would be able to find it, hopefully, say, yes. on the ACT website.
Yes, that's right. That's right. We're looking and doing all our due diligence. The wonderful thing is that the guy who wrote that particular episode fell in love with this play and told the playwright, Annie Washburn, that he would do anything to see this happen again. So that's very exciting. She's an extremely inventive writer. And I think it will suit both geeky audiences who just love that material and audiences who love narrative and storytelling who don't know anything about The Simpsons.
And we're way too early to talk about things like sets at this point, or are we?
Except that the great set designer Ralph Funicello is designing it, and to my mind, he is the problem solver of all time. You may remember Maple and Vine or the Voisey Inheritance. He's done many, many sets for us, and they're sets that you think, how do you solve that one? And then you go to Ralph Funicello.
Testament by Colm Tobin. It's based on a novella called Testament of Mary, which became a play.
Correct.
And it's a narrative of Jesus' final days from the Virgin Mary's perspective.
This is a play about a mother whose son has become, shall we say, in her view, a jihadist in some way, a terrorist. It's written by an Irish writer, truly one of the great, if you've interviewed him, you know, great, great writers of the 21st century, major Irish writer, major gay writer, one of the great writers about women. He writes among the great female characters ever. He took Mary, Mother of God, as a character. It's not religious, nor is it blasphemous. It's about a character, a mother whose son is killed in the most horrifying way, and 20 years later she is trying to understand what happened to him. Why did that happen? Why did people believe he was the Son of God? What does it mean to believe someone's the Son of God? Where does that put her as the mother? And why is she being told to tell a story in a way that she knows didn't happen, because the Gospels are being written and she's supposed to be part of it. So she needs us as the audience, and she talks right to us, and she tries to tell the story from her point of view. And the great Shauna McKenna is going to play Mary.
And you're going to direct that one. When you go into a season, do you point and say?
Absolutely. I fell in love with this piece. I cannot tell you why, but certain kind of writing just strikes my heart. And I'm a Jew. I'm not Christian. But it absolutely struck my heart. I just thought it was the most incredible writing. And immediately I could hear Shauna. So I know Colm Tobin. He writes beautifully on Beckett as well, and came to speak on the Geary stage about Beckett. And I said to him, I want to work on this. And there are many versions of this play. And so he's creating a version for us that combines some of the novella and some of the Broadway version and some of the Dublin version, which is very exciting. He's going to be here for rehearsals. And then I've been reading. This is an interesting moment, Richard, where a lot of great historians are wrestling with that period. There's a new book that's brilliant called When Jesus Became God. And there's another book by Risa Aslan, I'm sure you know about this, called Zealot. So this question of who these people were as real people and what we are to understand about them looking back in that moment is a very rich subject for inquiry and a great subject for drama.
And it seems, maybe it's coincidental, but it seems that if you're talking about plays dialoguing with each other, that one sort of dialogues with Mr. Burns.
Very much so. You know what I discovered after I put the season together? These are all plays about memory, the shards of memory, and rewriting narrative. How do we now talk about something that happened in the past? Because, of course, we always rewrite history to suit what we need to know now.
The next show actually is also about
That's
rewriting.
Right.
It's about a past affair. Stephen Sondheim and Hugh Wheeler's A Little Night Music.
We decided to do it. This has always been on the top of my list because it's so gorgeous and be so beautiful at the Geary. But it happened now because of Mark Lammas. So Mark is a director we've worked with before and love very much. And he had a conception of Little Night Music that he tested out about 4 years ago at Baltimore Center Stage that was exquisite. He stripped away the set. It was cobalt blue with just chandeliers and very minimal furniture. And the quintet, instead of being the same age as the principals, was very young. So it's like they sort of alter ego versions of themselves. And very sexy and very beautiful. And it was so captivating. I thought, what a wonderful way to reimagine A Little Night Music. Then we continued our dialogue with Dennis Garnham at Theatre Calgary because we'd had such a great co-production experience there. And we decided to co-produce Little Night Music with the Canadians. So it will have some Canadian stars and some American stars, some young artists. And that same incredible design team that created it with Mark. Tom Stoppard wrote Indian Ink in 1996. We did the American premiere here at ACT. It was a huge success. And guess what? It's never been seen in New York. How is a Tom Stoppard play like Indian Ink that is that exquisite not been seen in New York? The right moment had to come along. You know, it's always a mystery what makes somebody say yes to something. And now, suddenly, one day, a year ago, Todd Hames, who runs the Roundabout, called me and said, I want to do Indian Ink, and I want you to do it. And so I'm going to direct it there. It will open in September and run all fall in New York. And then it will come to San Francisco. We're going to bring it back here. I can't believe that 15 years later, New York is going to get to see this play.
So sometimes it's just it's a matter of circumstance that certain shows open and other shows don't.
Somebody has to champion it. There are a lot of plays out there, and every artistic director has very particular taste, and so sometimes plays land right away when they've been successful elsewhere, and sometimes they take years to land, and then they come back, or the zeitgeist changes, and suddenly they are a kind of current again.
I'm trying to get the sequence here. Old Hats.
Old Hats will start our season. Testament will come second. Christmas Carol, of course, comes next. Then comes Tom Stoppard's Indian Ink. Then comes Annie Washburn's Mr. Burns. And then comes Kwame Kwe Arma's Let There Be Love, which we've just announced. Kwame is a remarkable West Indian writer and director. He is now the artistic director of Baltimore Center Stage and is a major English playwright and was in Britain for many, many years. This is a play that I really fell in love with when I first read it. It's about an elderly West Indian man who has been relatively successful in Britain but is very alienated from his daughters. He's ill. And he gets a caregiver who is sent by social services to his house to look after him. And she is a young Polish woman. And in the beginning, it does not go well. He doesn't want her there. But they bond over music. He has a record player that he bought in the 60s that he still treasures. And he loves things like all that great genre of, like, Let There Be Love, that song, or Straighten Up and Fly Right, Charlie Parker, Mingus. And they bond over great music. And it's a story about immigration and change and alienation when one leaves one's home and final assimilation into another culture. It's being directed by a woman, Maria Myleaf, whom I think is extremely gifted at character work, and it will really introduce the Bay Area to a major playwright.
I notice, unless you call night music canon, and I'm not sure if I do, that this year there's no canon there.
Canon in terms of classical canon? Yes, you may be right. One of the things I love about classical theater is that it puts the world on stage. That's very important to me, that we're not doing all two-character, one-set contemporary plays. So when I look at something like Indian Ink, which takes place in the 30s and the present, or Little Night Music, which is so capacious, I do feel there are plays where the world is on stage. And that's the thing I think is really important, that plays are both social and individual.
in doing more musicals, that requires an orchestra. How are you going to deal with that for night music? Because I've seen it small and large.
This is a beautiful orchestration that was done for this particular production. It's 8 musicians. They'll be in the pit at the Geary, and I think it will sound exquisite there. The Geary's a very perfect sort of Baroque opera house, you know, so it suits that kind of music very well.
Carrie Perloff, have you started to plan what you're going to have at the Strand? Because we're talking 2015. We're talking next season.
We surely are. So we have what we call the Strand sweepstakes, Richard. We have a lot of work on commission and under development. We're looking at many projects to try and figure out what's the perfect way to start. And, of course, there are many demands, and you can never fulfill all of them in one production. And so we're really planning basically a whole opening season of work so that people will see the breadth of what the Strand can be. But one thing I will tell you about that's on commission that we're particularly excited about is a collection of short plays that are in response to a book of short stories called Monstrous by a Filipino writer working in the Bay Area today, a young man named Leslie Tenorio. I read a review of this book in the Chronicle 18 months ago. I grabbed the book. I read the stories. I fell in love with his writing. I met with Leslie and said, I want to make plays out of this. We're moving into a neighborhood that's heavily Filipino. Let's do this work. We commissioned Coleman Domingo, Sean San Jose, Philip Cangotanda, Fabiano Bispo, and Jessica Hagedorn to make work in response to these stories, and so far the results have been magical. So you'll see that at the Strand for sure at some point.
MFA Productions will be continuing, I guess, at Zeum or
nope.
not?
Are no we done Zeum? With Zeum? We are done with Zeum.
Really?
We absolutely are. They're at the costume shop right now at our funky 49th Street wonderful space at 7th and Market, and then they will also be at the Strand. Our MFA program, also our Young Conservatory program, will be very visible at the Strand, and our education program will finally have a real home up there for our high school students.
Are you expanding the conservatory at that point, the teaching end of it, because you have more venues?
Well, the MFA program is its own elite program, and they do a number of productions. It means their productions will be much more visible. And I've always thought it was sort of a shame that we have this jewel here in San Francisco, and people don't see it enough because they don't have their own venue. So now the MFA program will have a venue that is really identified with them, and I think people will begin to see what remarkable young talent we have.
Are you going to be allowing those theaters, the 2 Strand theaters and Costume Shop? I know Costume Shop, now you sometimes farm it out to other companies.
This was Ellen Richards' idea, and it has been so moving and so community building, is that we have a community space sharing program where we give away this Costume Shop space to smaller groups, theater, spoken word, dance, all kinds of work, and that has been wonderful. So if we can continue to get the funding to do this, we will give away the Strand as well to community groups.
There have been rumors that they're trying to get other theater companies like the Magic over there, trying to turn it more into a theater area. Are you familiar with any of that? And if you are, then what's that process happening with?
Well, everybody is hoping that San Francisco will develop an arts use district for Central Market, and that would incent developers to put artist space in the ground floors. It depends on how it goes through the political process, but if that happens, then yes, you will be seeing more nonprofit arts organizations in that corridor.
Carrie Perloff, what about your own work? Are you directing anything outside of ACT?
My next 6 months are insane. So we do Orphan of Zhao here. Then I take Orphan of Zhao to the La Jolla Playhouse. As soon as that is over, I start Indian Ink at the Roundabout. When Indian Ink finishes at the Roundabout, I come back here and do Testament. Then Indian Ink comes here. In the meantime, a play that I wrote called Kinship is opening in Paris, starring Isabella Gianni, if you can imagine, in October. So I have a lot of writing going on as well, and that seems to all be landing at the same time.
How do you fit in the writing in terms of the actually being an administrator and a director?
Well, it's hard, but it's also very life-sustaining. The writing is the one time I can tell my own stories and do my own thing. And I write a lot in the summer. I write a lot late at night, and it gives me a lot of pleasure.
Yeah. Other than that, any of your other plays being produced? Or?
We're working on Higher down at the La Jolla Playhouse. We just did a wonderful workshop with Linda Lavin, who was from Heaven in the role, and John Tenney. So I'm hoping that'll happen down there the following year.
And for the future of ACT, obviously you haven't got anything in the can for after that that you can announce, but what kind of plays are you looking at? Is there anything specific? You're planning, say, in the future to have any kind of almost series of plays on particular themes or not?
I don't think I think thematically so much as stylistically and globally. You know, I would like the Strand to be a place where both really vigorous, exciting younger artists can stretch their wings and where international work can be seen, which we don't see enough of in the Bay Area. The more we know about world theater, the more interesting our own theater is going to be. I want to keep unusual classics alive, which is very important to me and something that I think is sort of disappearing. Great virtuosic acting I always really love. And ways to use all the tools at our disposal. So I continue to be really excited about dance theater, about music theater, about theater. You know, I don't tend to do television dramas or movies of the week kind of plays. That's what I mean. I don't really think thematically. I love theater that wakes us up to the fact that it's theater, and in so doing, lets us as audience members play. And I think the biggest gift you can give to an audience member is to stimulate his or her imagination to want to play and to make work themselves. And in that regard, I'll tell you about one other new initiative at ACT, which is thrilling. We just got an Irvine grant to support a project we call Stagecoach, which is to get a mobile unit to make work and participatory work in underserved neighborhoods around the Bay Area, so that ACT will not only be in our homes, but bringing creative endeavors to the Bayview, to the Excelsior, and to neighborhoods that haven't traditionally been served as much by theater.
How about over in the East Bay?
This is San Francisco focused, this particular project, for now. We do a lot of educational work in the East Bay, a great deal.
Carrie Perloff, finally, have you ever thought about film?
It's not my medium. It doesn't interest me. I like live experience. I love watching something happen in real time. I get impatient. Even in great film, I get impatient. It's canned, and my response to it doesn't make any difference. It's done and done. Whereas you sit in a theater as an audience member, and every move you make impacts what happens on stage. I love dance. As you know, I go to a lot of dance. I love music. But film isn't my medium. I was asked by Isabella Gianni, who's doing my play, if she could think about a film of it, and I said, absolutely, but somebody else would have to make it. There are great, talented people who do that much better than I.
There's something immediate and real about theater, and that if you go to the same play four times,
that's right,
you're seeing four plays.
That's what's thrilling. And I don't think people realize the impact they have sitting in that audience on those actors. Believe me, the actors can feel it. They can feel when you're ahead of them. They can feel when you're bored. They can feel when you're with them. They can feel when you fall in love. And that's a magical feedback loop.
You've been listening to an interview with Carrie Perloff, the artistic director of ACT, American Conservatory Theater in San Francisco. Venus and Fur runs through this weekend, and The Suit begins on April 22nd. For more information, you can go to their website, act-sf.org. I'm Richard Walensky on Open Book.